Hello and welcome to Word Magazine. This is Jeff Riddle, pastor of Christ Reformed Baptist Church in Louisa, Virginia. And in this episode of Word Magazine, I'm going to be offering reading and some responses to a recent article that was published in November 2018 in a journal called Didacticos Journal that can be found at didacticosjournal.com. This journal has as its, a subheading, A Journal of Theological Education. And of course, the title Didacticos comes from the Greek word in 1 Timothy 3:3, describing the fact that an overseer has to be didacticos. He has to be apt to teach. And so this is a journal where people who teach in the field of Bible and religion and theology can post articles about their discipline and practice of their discipline and new trends in their discipline and so forth. And so this article was written by Peter Gurry, Dr. Peter Gurry, who teaches at Phoenix Seminary. And Dr. Gurry, I've mentioned him before in different podcasts and on my blog. He did a PhD in text criticism at Cambridge and is one of the foremost experts on the new coherence-based genealogical method. He wrote a book recently with Tommy Wasserman, A New Approach to Textual Criticism, An Introduction to the Coherence-Based Genealogical Method. I haven't quite finished reading that yet. I plan to read it and write a review of it. But anyway, this is just a shorter article, and it has as its title, The Quiet Renaissance in Textual Criticism. And so he says there is this quiet, unassuming renaissance that is going on in the field of textual criticism. And he lays out three major advances that are changing the field. They are new resources, new methods, and new additions. And I thought that he touched on some rather interesting things. Obviously, he's an advocate for the modern critical text, is not an advocate for the traditional text. But I think what he shares in this brief article is very interesting for anyone who's interested in the field. And I believe it shows some of the inherent weaknesses in those who have embrace fully the modern critical text. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read the article and stop and make some observations along the way. As usual, I'm going to do a blog post that's going to accompany this edition of Word Magazine on my blog, jeffriddle.net. I will have a link to this brief article, which you can download a PDF of the article, read it for yourself. And if there are any other things I mention along the way, I'll also have some links to those as well. I'm kind of just doing this off the cuff today. I'm not really following a pre-written script or text, but I'm just going to make observations as I go. So there's a little introduction. It says, Dr. Gurry says, to interpret a text requires a text to interpret. This fact is so axiomatic that it is often taken for granted. In the case of the New Testament, however, we possess thousands of differing witnesses to its text, and the work of cataloging these differences, identifying the most important ones, and eventually restoring the original as far as possible is known as textual criticism. As many who teach the subject know, the history of this discipline is a rich and varied one, with colorful characters, fantastic discoveries, and some of what can only be called splendid failures. What is less known is that textual criticism has been undergoing a quiet renaissance for over a decade now. And here I wish to introduce three examples of that. So just to pause for a moment, I think he's absolutely right. Text criticism is foundational. I mean, if you're going to do preaching, if you're going to do exegesis, the first thing you have to do is establish what the text is. So this is a foundational issue. Text criticism is not an unimportant issue. I find it interesting the definition that he gives for text criticism. And I think this is the problem with evangelicals like Gurry, who are steeped in the modern critical method with regard to the text of the Bible. But they're still trying to hold on to the older, more modern understandings of text criticism. And so he defines text criticism as this process whereby the aim is eventually, as he puts it, restoring the original. And then he puts in parentheses, as far as possible. He says, this is the discipline of textual criticism. And one of the critiques we've had of the modern reconstructionist text criticism is that it only claims that it can approximate the text. It never actually arrives at the text. It can get us very close to it, perhaps, but it cannot really say this is the text. There's always going to be a question mark about the text if we buy into text criticism, because new manuscripts could always be discovered, new methods could always be applied. And one of the things that we've noted repeatedly is that one of the advantages of sticking with the traditional text is that you don't have a text that is constantly unstable, lacking in stability. So he's going to give these three examples of this renaissance that's undergoing, currently underway, in the field of text criticism. And I do think this is interesting. He says, you know, really, this has happened in the last 10 years. And I've noted this in a number of my reviews, critiques, rejoinders to people like James White. A lot of these people often are dealing with the old models of text criticism. They're talking about text families. They're deriding the Byzantine text. And they don't acknowledge often that really text criticism has shifted. Most fundamentally, modern text critics are not so interested in this whole restoration, reconstruction process. They've pretty much given up on that. And also in postmodern fashion, they're saying, you know, we can't really narrow the text down to one single text. We have to talk about the text of Scripture. And there's got to be a pluriformity of texts, and they're all equally valid. If they represent Gnostic thought, then that's as valid as something that represents Orthodox thought. And again, evangelicals who have embraced text criticism are sometimes flustered by this, because people who are not evangelicals, people who are more secular, they've pretty much abandoned the search for the original text. And evangelicals who get into the field are attempting to master these new approaches and still trying to hang on to the old goals of modern text criticism. You know, I was talking about James White. You know, he often talks about, well, the papyri are so important, and this text family, that text family. And, you know, he's just been, speaking using the old terminology. Here lately, of course, he started this PhD program at a university in South Africa. Now he's all interested in the coherence-based genealogical method. I'll be curious to hear what he has to say, because he's derided the Byzantine text for so long. And one of the things that this new method, the coherence-based theological or genealogical method, has done is it has said, hey, a lot of the Byzantine readings are, in fact, we think the older and the preferred readings. And so it kind of smashes those who were very negative about the Byzantine text. But anyway, he gives three examples. Let's start off with new resources. So I'm back to reading Gurry's article. He says, the first important change is the availability of new resources in the form of digital images and online software. It used to be that you had to travel to Europe to see our most valuable witnesses, but those days are long gone. Organizations like the Center for the Study of New Testament Manuscripts, along with libraries and museums, are making their images available free online. In my classes, I have found that students come alive when they see these images on screen. With a few clicks, we can be looking at the lack of, quote, in Ephesus, end quote, in Ephesians 1:1 in the earliest copy, Papyrus 46. Things get more interesting still when I point out that even with the address missing, the book is still titled To the Ephesians, just as it is in almost all manuscripts. From there, we are off and running looking at the correction of Mark 1:1 in Codex Sinaiticus, or the much-discussed dots in Codex Vaticanus involving 1 Corinthians 14, verses 34 and 35. Seeing these artifacts in high resolution makes textual criticism leap off the apparatus. Let me just pause here for a moment and make a few comments before I head to the next paragraph in this section on new resources. So he makes the point, it's a very valid point, we are in the midst of a technological revolution. that's touching not just the field of biblical studies or textual criticism, but all fields in the humanities. And that is, we've entered into the digital age. Just as we believe that, you know, it was a technological revolution in the 16th century when the printing press was invented, and we saw how that affected Protestant Reformation. We just passed the 501st anniversary of Martin Luther tacking up his 95 theses to the church door at Wittenberg, and then these were printed and disseminated. And who knows, Luther could have been burned at the stake like Huss if he had lived a generation earlier without the printing press. But instead, his writings were printed, they were copied, they were distributed, they were read, and a revolution, a protest got underway. And so there was a digital revolution, and that affected then the printing of the Bible. Erasmus prints the Bible, the Greek New Testament, for the first time in 1516. So scholars are able to have a printed copy of the Bible to make translations and so forth. And obviously we believe that God was providentially involved in that. But we're living through now a new technological revolution, the digital age. And one of the things about this age, as he rightly points out, is we now have, at the click of a mouse, access to many of these great manuscripts. You can look at Codex Sinaiticus online. You can look at Codex Alexandrinus online. You can look at Codex Vaticanus online. You can search them. You can do close-ups. And these are things that in a generation past, you would have to be able to go and travel to libraries all over the world, or you would have to rely on very expensive facsimile copies of these things that were deposited only in some libraries. And it would take a lot of work to get all this material together. But now it's very accessible. Many of these can be, again, looked at online, and more as they're being photographed digitally and being uploaded somewhere to the net. He continues, more manuscript images are available at the New Testament Virtual Manuscript Room, which is maintained by the Institute for New Testament Textual Research. And this is the Institute, I think, in Germany. This remarkable expanding software can take you all the way from digital image to the final major critical edition, with stops along the way to see transcriptions, conjectures, bibliographies, and the official, now digital, list of New Testament manuscripts. Your students can even get involved in the process of tagging images to make them easier for others to use. It really is a first port of call for textual criticism. And again, this is just another example of the incredible resources that are now available. And I know, although I'm not teaching students Greek, I know even in my survey of the New Testament class, I do pull up a few digital images of manuscripts and talk a little bit about how the manuscripts were handwritten. And I show them, and they can, even if you don't read Greek, you can see in the old unsealed manuscripts that there are no spaces between words and there's no punctuation. And, you know, they get a sense of some of the difficulties of reading a text like this, or how different it is, or the fact that the chapter and verse divisions were not there in the handwritten manuscripts, that came along later. So it is an amazing resource. So the second example of the quiet renaissance, he describes as new methods. And so let me return to Gurry, and here's the first paragraph in that section. He writes, mention of the virtual manuscript room leads to the next major development, which is the rise of new text critical methods. In classical textual criticism, determining manuscript relationships has long been a first step in producing a critical edition. For the New Testament, this is problematic. But the advent of computer processing raises new possibilities. For example, Stephen Carlson has applied a modified form of cladistics to isolate the simplest set of relationships between more than 90 witnesses of Galatians. He then uses that analysis to recover Paul's original text. And he makes reference here to a monograph that I, quite frankly, have not read, again, by this fellow named Stephen Clausen. And he apparently has done some text critical work on Galatians and has attempted to reconstruct what he believes is the original text of Galatians. I think it would be interesting to take a look at really what he did with that, whether he tried to get back to the initial text or so-called initial text or the original text. Was he trying to recreate the manuscript as it existed in 200 or as it existed in 400 or as it existed from the pen of Paul? And he apparently is using this method that's called cladistics, which I've never heard of. In the footnotes, Gurry explains that cladistics, that's C-L-A-D-I-S-T-I-C-S, refers to a method originally developed for biology of hypothesizing relationships among organisms. And the work here, Stephen Carlson, is the text of Galatians and its history, published in Germany by Moore Seebeck in 2015. So here is an effort to use a biological method, although I guess there's not much new in that regard, because I believe that the evolutionary theory was certainly influential in the development understanding of modern text criticism. So here they're using cladistics, whatever that is, to analyze the text. Now, let's return to Gurry, his second paragraph here under New Methods. He says, more prominent still is a method developed by the Institute for New Testament Textual Research, known as the Coherence-Based Genealogical Method, the CBGM. Let me just pause here for a moment and note that I did do a Word Magazine on this back in 2017. It's Word Magazine number 73, and I'll put a link to that when I do the blog post. So returning to Gurry, he says, this approach uses the editor's own textual decisions at all points of variation, combined with the general agreement or coherence between witnesses to relate these witnesses to each other. The resulting relationships are used to study how and where the text is most likely to have changed. For example, if two witnesses are not very similar overall, then it may be less likely that they are related at an individual point of variation. This type of information can be especially useful for resolving otherwise difficult variations. So far, the method has been used on Acts and the Catholic Letters, and the results are available online. Notably, the CBGM has brought with it a move away from the long-standing notion of text types, a reappraisal of the origins and value of the Byzantine text, a slight shift in the editor's goal, and dozens of textual changes. So, again, you can listen to my Word Magazine 73 on this new method. This is a method that is changing the landscape of contemporary text criticism, and anybody who writes in the field has to be aware of this. Again, as already noted, talking about how some of the shifts in James White's approach as the CBGM has arose and he's attempting to embrace it. One of the things that it does is it challenges the Westcott-Hort era idea of text types and text families. So people are not so much talking anymore about the Alexandrian text or the Western text or the Caesarean text, although they do still talk about the Byzantine text. And as Gurry points out, there's been a reappraisal of the origins and the value of the Byzantine text. They're actually now saying some of the Byzantine readings are the earliest. Sometimes even if they're in a minuscule manuscript, they may say this is a better reading than what we find in one of the papyrus. And then a shift in the editor's goal. I think he's referring to the fact that they're not looking for the original text, but trying to find so-called initial text, or they're trying to trace it back simply as far as they can go, and it's created a lot of individual textual changes. The third thing that he points to as an example in this quiet renaissance that is happening in text criticism is the fact that there are new editions of the Greek New Testament that are being produced. And so here's Gurry again. He says, finally, a discussion of the CBGM brings us to new editions of the Greek New Testament. The CBGM's importance is due in no small part to its use by the editors of the Nestle-Aland 28th edition and the United Bible Society's 5th edition. Both editions have been updated in the Catholic Letters, with further revisions expected to appear by 2022. So let me just pause here. In 4 years, we should expect that there's going to be a Nestle-Aland 29th edition, in which the CBGM is going to be applied to at least the Catholic epistles and perhaps other parts of the New Testament. I think the book of Revelation is something they're working on. And then also then there will be corresponding new United Bible Societies. The 6th edition will come out. The texts of the NA28 and the UBS 6th presumably will be the same, but the apparati will be different in them. So Gurry continues. He says, in all, there are just over 30 textual changes, the most important being those in 2 Peter 3:10 and Jude 5. So in the Catholic epistles, which were changed in the most recent handbooks, the NA28, the UBS 5th edition, 30 various changes, more than 30, I think, actually. And two of the major ones were 2 Peter 3:10, where a conjecture was added, and Jude 5, where instead of Lord, it uses Jesus. And I did Word magazines on both these issues. You can look at Word magazine number 77 on Jude 5 and the changes made in the most recent critical editions. And in Word magazine 91, I dealt with 2 Peter 3:10. Gurry continues, these changes also came with new weight assigned to newly cited witnesses in the apparatus, and a new symbol, which is a black diamond, which replaces the square brackets and indicates greater editorial uncertainty. Teachers who use the NA28 and the UBS 5th edition will need to become familiar with what's new in order to help students make wise use of these editions. So he does point out, again, that in these newer editions, there is a movement away from the brackets, like previous editions, they would bracket, say, the ending of Mark 16, 9 through 20, or they would bracket the woman caught in adultery. And now the tendency is to put a black diamond in places to say it's textually uncertain. And again, one of the problems with the modern critical text is there's a lot of uncertainty, lack of stability in the text. Let's see, closing paragraph now from, next to last closing paragraph from Gurry on the new editions. He says, finally, even as the CBGM has increased the NA28 and UBS 5th editors' confidence in later manuscripts, another set of editors have taken a decidedly different approach. In the recently published Greek New Testament produced at Tyndale House, Cambridge, the editors have used what we might call a documentary approach. In practice, this means they have followed the earliest manuscripts not only for determining the text, but also for deciding matters of paragraphing, spelling, and even accenting. The presentation is intentionally minimalist, with no text-critical symbols accompanying the small apparatus, no headings, and even no hyphens. The resulting edition is ideal for immersive reading and for challenging unconscious assumptions about how to read key passages. Note, for instance, the paragraph breaks at John 1:6 and 1:15, at John 1:6 and 1:15, and the lack of one at Romans 3:21. So let me pause again. So among these new editions, and in addition to the more familiar scholarly handbooks and their latest editions, the NA28 and the UBS 5th edition, he mentions this new Greek New Testament that has been produced by a group of evangelical scholars at Tyndale House. And I also did a review of this in Word Magazine 84, which you can listen to. And I've actually now published a written review of that edition of the Greek New Testament that was published recently in Puritan Reformed Journal. And I need to post it to my academia.edu site. I haven't done that yet. I will eventually. And again, it's unusual in that it's a kind of a different approach, following the approach of the 19th century scholar Tregelis, where they try to have some early manuscript that supports every reading that they choose. And Gurry refers to it as a documentary approach. The final paragraph here in the section on new editions, Gurry says, having these new editions of the Greek text may well require exegetes and teachers to pay closer attention to textual criticism than in the past. Not only will we hear, but my translation says in the classroom, but we are increasingly going to hear, but my Greek edition says. Although there has never been a consensus on the Greek text, the end of the NA 27 UBS fourth era, if we may call it that, requires a renewed level of engagement from those of us who teach. So that's a very interesting point. So he's saying, whereas in the past, students might have said, but your translation says this, but my translation says this. He says, now we're getting to the point where there aren't just conflicting modern translations, but we're getting to the point where there may be conflicting editions of the Greek New Testament. So somebody might say, well, my NA 28 says this. Another person says, but my Tyndale House Greek New Testament says this. And so I don't know. I think that may be a little bit pie in the sky. I mean, it's fairly easy if you live in the US or the UK or Australia or maybe in today, increasingly in other places in the world, to speak English and to read an English Bible. But the number of people really who can, with a lot of facility, read Greek are really not that many. But perhaps at least among scholars, there'll be these types of discussions. But my Greek New Testament says this or says that. And again, he sees this as something that's wonderful. It's an advancement. But we might compare it to some of the problems we've had in the churches with the multiplicity of translations, so that a pastor says, let's turn to this book, this chapter, this verse. And we have people turning, and there may be 20 different translations in a typical broad evangelical church. Somebody's using the King James, somebody's using the New Living Translation, somebody's using the ESV, and heaven forbid someone's using the Message. And I'm not sure that's an advancement. It's an advancement of Babel, it's an advancement of confusion. And do we want the same thing to happen with the Greek New Testament? I mean, he says that there's never been a consensus on the Greek New Testament. And I don't think that's exactly right. There was a consensus on the Textus Receptus, on the received text. And that consensus held among Protestants from the 16th century on through to the 19th century. So we at least had a consensus during that period. And I believe there was a consensus in the early church about the proper text of the Bible as well. And I think God providentially preserved his word. And so there has been a divine consensus upon what the word is. And again, is it an advancement if we have a cacophony of different translations and now different editions of the Greek New Testament? I'm not sure. I think that's great. I know David C. Parker did a lecture some years ago where he talked about, he hypothesized that in the future, you might be able just to create your own Greek New Testament. And he, sees this day where, I don't know, you remember I think they still exist, these stores that used to be in malls that were called Build-A-Bear. And you would take your kid in there and they would create their own stuffed animal. They would, choose the stuffed animal they wanted. They would put the fluff in there. They would decorate it the way they want. And so you get this personalized, individualized Build-A-Bear. And some people, it seems, want to do this with the Greek New Testament. You just go in there and you create the New Testament you like. You look at the different variants and the readings, and you adjudicate which one you think is best, and you make your bet. If you think that the traditional ending of Mark is original, then you keep it in there. If you don't like it, you take that out, or you substitute the shorter ending. Or if you don't like the women taken in adultery, just put it down in the footnotes and take it out of the text. Again, I don't see that necessarily as an improvement. I see that as creating a lot of chaos, a lot of anarchy with the text of the Christian scriptures, and undermining the authority of Christian theology, of Christian teaching, of confessionalism. But other people see it as a renaissance, something that's wonderful that's taking place. So here's Gurry's conclusion. These developments are pouring fresh energy into textual criticism, and it is now time they trickle down into the classroom. This not only keeps students up to date, but also engages them more directly in the fascinating history of the Bible. As B.F. Westcott told a group of junior clergy, quote, "It cannot be a matter of indifference to know how the New Testament has come down to us, to look at the manuscripts from which our fathers drew words of life, to trace the stirring history of the version through which the teaching of the apostles has been made accessible to men of other tongues," end quote. And then Gurry says, "Today, the developments mentioned here have made it possible to explore that history with our students like never before." And so that ends the article. I think most of the articles in this journal are properly, you know, quite short, so that a busy professor, they're not meant to be like research articles, but just overview articles. And I do think it is a very interesting article. And again, I'll put a link to the PDF so you can download it, read it for yourself. So I think it's interesting and sort of giving you a perspective from someone who's, I think, as up to date as anyone on recent changes in the field of text criticism. We are seeing profound changes in the approach to the text of the New Testament. And it will be interesting to see in years to come how evangelicals respond to this, and also how those who are conservative, reformed, confessional respond to this. Of course, I've made it clear in many of these Word magazines that I believe a better alternative than following and trying to adapt to every change that the academy presents, a better alternative is to stick with the traditional text, and a text that's not going to change from year to year, but one that is steady, one that has proven itself to be true, one that has been the basis for the Protestant translations. And so I would say stick with the Masoretic text of the Hebrew Bible for the Old Testament, and stick with the Textus Receptus or the received text as the foundational determinative text for the New Testament. Well, I hope that this brief review of the article, The Quiet Renaissance in Textual Criticism, has been interesting and profitable for you. And I will look forward to speaking to you in our next Word magazine. Till then, take care and God bless.